What's interesting about the Lightwood frame is that it's kind of both. It's kind of a structural skeleton, and at the same time, you think about it as a continuous wall. Structurally, it'll behave like a wall. It'll shed loads like a wall, move loads like a wall, but we can poke holes in it almost anywhere without a lot of effort, and we can convert part of the wall into a column just by building up a couple of two-bys. We do that at corners kind of all the time. If you wanted to know more about framing and details for Lightwood construction, this one, I'd really recommend this one. This guy, Rob Fallon, put this guide together, and you'll see some illustrations from this. It is published by the people who do fine home building, and that's another one of those things. If somebody asks you, what do you want for a holiday gift that doesn't start with an I, isn't an iPod or something like that. The subscription to fine home building is pretty good because they have pretty good stories in there, and they'll show you how to do things. It's always a little bit expensive and eccentric, but they'll show you. The other people who are interested in you knowing how to build out of wood is the APA, used to be the American Plywood Association. I think they just call themselves the American Panel Association now because they represent the oriented strand board people as well. So it's everybody who deals with structural panels. So they're real interested, and they've got guides up on their website. And the building code has actually gone so far as to tell you how to do details, how certain connections should be made. So if you really get stumped for something, you can actually just look at the International Residential Code, and it'll tell you exactly how many nails, what's the spacing, how many square inches of what kind of wood do you need here. So there are some references that'll help you with this. But building out of wood, these little two-bys, unlike timber framing, which is all dependent on chopping that big chunk of tree into wooden connectors and actually using wooden pins, wooden dowels. I guess if you go up into Pennsylvania Dutch region up here, just north of us a little ways, they'll talk about those pegs that they put in the timber frame as tree nails. They think about them as they're wooden nails, effectively, those pegs. You'll hear them say the word trunnel instead of tree nail. That's just their conjunction of it. Because nails were one of the most expensive materials in the world for, gosh, since the time of Rome till just around the Civil War. People would forage through burned out buildings and scavenge nails and straighten them out and reuse them. And from that time of Rome through the colonial era, they didn't change the way they made nails. You took molten metal, you poured it into a form that gave you a square rod, and you took that square rod, which is also called nail stock, and you'd take that home if you were a farmer, and all winter when you couldn't be out working in the field, you would be in there with your anvil and chisel, and you'd be heating up that rod in your forge. You'd have your kids stepping on the bellows or turning the crank on the bellows to get it hot enough to make that steel so you could cut it with a chisel. Then you put it in a wooden form and you would hammer the top of that nail stock until it made a head, and that would be one nail. And then you'd make more. And you'd sell those nails basically to buy your seed or buy your salt to help you with your self-sufficiency. So it's kind of a cottage industry. But we can find lots of Roman nails. You even see them on eBay every once in a while. It's hard to tell if they're real ones or just rusted out regular ones, though. I don't know how you could tell a Roman nail from a North Dakotan nail. So they were sort of a precious resource, were really expensive at one time, and that basically kept the timber framers, kept them busy, because no one could really afford to spend that much money on fasteners. After the Civil War, though, a couple of things changed. And I think, I want to say it was around 1795 that some of the first patents for automatic nail-making machines were issued. First ones were basically you take a sheet of steel and be able to cut it into a tapered form, and as you cut it, another anvil would come in and smack it on the end and put a head on it, and you'd be able to produce thousands of those. They called them cut nails. We still have cut nails today. But you could produce thousands a day instead of hundreds or dozens. And so by 1869, after the Civil War, nail prices are down, and this thing called the balloon frame is starting to become the construction method of choice as America expands westward into the prairie. One of the problems when you went out onto the prairie, you went out into these places where there weren't a lot of people and the farms were kind of big, was you didn't have any help. I don't know, you remember that scene in the Harrison Ford movie, Witness, where they put up the timber frame on the farm for the barn, and hundreds of people are there, and some of them are laying out the timber frame joinery, some of them are lifting and hoisting the frame, some of them are providing food and water. It was a timber frame, it was kind of a community activity, and all generations could take part. You needed the older people who knew how to lay out the complex joinery. You needed the younger people who had just a lot of muscle and didn't have a lot of experience. When you went out west, it was basically you and maybe your spouse and maybe one child, and you got out to these prairies in the Midwest, and there were no trees. Like, what do? We got to make shelter. But there were railroads about the same time, and so you could actually get lumber and put it on your wagon and haul it out to your homestead, and the balloon frame was the first way you could make your own shelter. So you didn't have to have an expert. Pretty much anybody who could take and cut a piece of 2x something square and drive a nail in it could be a carpenter. And that's kind of where, you know, our tradition of owner home builder kind of started back then. So the nails become plentiful, and we still talk about them in this. We talk about them as a 10-penny or an 8-penny nail or a 16-penny nail. And that all goes back to England, when basically it was how much you paid a blacksmith to make 100 nails of that size. And of course, we don't use that yet today, so we use it really to talk about the length of the nail right now and the thickness. And penny is really, when we write it, we write it as a 10D nail or an 8D nail or a 16D. And that goes back to this denarius, which was the Roman coinage, basically the Roman currency, because Rome basically built England. So it's all connected. So we go all the way back to Rome with our terminology. Our slides aren't happy today. So the bigger the nail, basically, the more load capacity the connection can have. We use these 16-penny nails, 16D nails, for most of our structural framing, most of our stud-to-stud. We're going to talk about beams and lintels and headers. Most of those connections are made by driving two or three of these into the connection between the two pieces of wood. And they pretty much work by friction. That's pretty much all that's happening. They force the wood fibers apart, and some of them actually have coatings on them so that they're harder to get out. In fact, if you try to pull one with a hammer, after you pull it out of the wood, it's hot because of that friction. It makes a lot of noise, squeaks. The tens and the eights are used primarily where we're putting sheathing together, fastening other things. And these are all the kind of broad-headed nails. We've got all kinds of other ones as well. The building code will tell us exactly how many have to be in every connection. And so this is there for your reference. So every one of these sorts of connections, and we're going to start talking about these parts, they have between 2 to 3. Some of them have 8. Yeah, it's a double top plate. 16-penny nails in them. The nail guns will basically shoot either preformed nails, or some of them will shoot like a wire in and almost make a nail head on their own right now. But we've got all kinds of them. This is the sort of nail that was first patented. It was closest to that one. We'll still use that today when we have to temporarily fasten wood to concrete. We'll do it because these are usually made out of harder steel, and you can drive them into concrete. I think if you looked at the edge of Kogel Hall, where they just took out the big precast panels and they're trying to form, they're widening out the foundation wall for a new wall on the bottom floor there. They're using a combination of these, and they actually have some of these that they drive in, and they don't drive them with a hammer. They have a 22 caliber gun, basically, that shoots those in. Redheads, they call them, or ramsets, or powerheads. There are a couple of different names for them. But they all start to change depending on their use. Like, sometimes we're really hoping that the nail head will disappear. We'd like to be able to drive it through a piece of trim and be able to close that up with a little bit of putty and make the nail head kind of go away. Sometimes we really want a lot of surface area underneath that nail head, so when we're nailing it into soft materials like asphalt shingles or tar paper, we almost want a nail that's got a built-in washer. So there's all kinds of different nails out there for different purposes. The wood that we're going to use to make these light wood frames are restricted in species. So over time, we've kind of figured out that, you know, even though we can find houses in Blacksburg framed out of oak, we know that it's not a really good use of oak to frame houses. Oak is too precious, takes too long to grow. Chestnut, cherry, the same thing. So most of our industry now is focused on this combination of species, spruce, pine, and fir, which we're going to hear people talk about as SPF lumber, spruce, pine, fir, for our vertical framing. So for our columns, our posts, our studs, that's what we're going to use. And anytime we have to have something that spans, we're going to be looking at DFL, Douglas fir or larch. And both of those things, for light wood framing, the codes are going to talk about structural light framing grades of lumber. So we're talking about either SPF or DFL. Now, it gets a little more complicated, because remember, the lumber graders were watching those sticks of wood come out of the saw and putting chalk marks on them so that we could stamp them. What they're stamping is basically the quality of the wood. So in this SPF, we'll have a construction stamp, a construction grade, that we can use for most framing things. They're not pretty. If you have an owner that needs exposed framing, this is not going to be a good answer. We'll look at another one in a minute. Standard grade, which is also for, it's a little better. Now, they're almost about the same, actually. A little more strength. Utility grade, we won't want to see that in any structural locations. So if we're walking around and looking at a frame under construction, we don't want to see that stamp that says utility grade on a column or on anything that we're depending on. So we'll use that maybe only to put pieces of wood between the studs so that we got something solid to screw the towel bar, the drape track, hang a cabinet from, something like that. Non-load-bearing purposes. And then stud grade, that's what we're going to see specified for the verticals in the wall. And usually we're not doing one size fits all. We're choosing between these grades because costs kind of go directly with those. We're trying to optimize costs. So if we don't need appearance and all we need is vertical load bearing, then stud grade is really good for us. When we get to spanning, this is where we get to appearance quality things, because now the grain of the wood has to be parallel to the length of the board. There can't be hardly any slope to the grain in this stuff. And the most beautiful is select structural. So that pine cone pavilion that we just looked at, where all those pieces of wood were really kind of pretty, that was all select structural. The most expensive wood you can buy. Well, outside of some of the engineered lumbers. Most expensive of the solid sawn stuff. And then it goes down, number one, number two, number three. And basically as the grade goes down like that, what you're having is a loss of strength. So it's got a defect in it. Either the grain is sloped too much, or there's a check in it, or there's a knot in a critical zone in it. It's something that's degrading the strength of that thing ultimately. So the code only lets us use like 25% of the allowable fiber bending stress for number three when we do our structural calculations. Which means the engineer can solve that problem by throwing more wood at a connection, more wood at a condition, or can upgrade to a higher quality piece of wood. But if you need appearance grade for architectural reasons, select structural is what you want to specify. We talked about moisture a little bit. And we saw that one stamp that we had that was labeled S-dry. That just means we've put the lumber in a kiln and driven it down to 19% moisture content. You'll see in some places MC-15 lumber. That's just it's dried down to 15%. And we usually don't go below that because that's where it starts picking up moisture out of the air. When you go to Phoenix, when you go to Arizona, California, and New Mexico, they actually might not dry their lumber at all because it's such a dry climate. It's going to dry sitting in the yard. It's it's going to dry, sitting on the job site. And that's, they call it green lumber. When you work with that, it's a little tricky because when lumber has moisture in it, it's not as strong. So some of the connections, some of the joining conditions will seem over-designed to you, but it's because that it's designed for green lumber. As that lumber shrinks, of course, I think that's why old floors squeak. You know, as that joist shrinks, the nail doesn't follow it, doesn't go down with it. So the lumber gets smaller, the nail basically stays where it is, and what's in between that piece of plywood rides up and down on that nail as that floor bends, and that's where the squeak comes from. I think a lot of home builders, a lot of people who are trying to get higher quality are actually putting glue down on top of the joists and then using screws instead of nails in order to eliminate that squeak. So green lumber is its own peculiar animal. They actually have spring-loaded bolted connections that will tighten the bolt as the lumber shrinks. Really got to be expensive. I've never built this that way. So this is our balloon frame. What characterizes it is a solid stick 1-2-by that goes from the foundation all the way up to the top plate, all the way up to the where the roof meets the wall. And when they started out, that was basically, it was almost like timber framing. You'd put each one of these studs up one at a time. So it was kind of tricky. You got this 18-foot piece of lumber, and you're trying to line it up on a mark at the bottom and try to get somebody up on a ladder up on the top, and kind of tricky. But we still see it today. And I'll show you one of those in a second. So continuous 2x4, that's the balloon frame. And then what they'll do is they'll just notch in a piece of lumber to carry the floor joist. So it's being carried effectively in shear at that point. It'll almost always have this is the old style of wind bracing. You'd take and cut notches into the face of the studs to get that diagonal brace there. And they would use that basically to put the corners up first. So these things would hold the corners up, just like a tripod, I guess. You get the two corner principles up, span across with a plate, and then start filling in with studs. The sheathing back then was all boards. This is kind of civilized. It's all boards of the same dimension. This one I shot in central Colorado a few summers ago. This was the 1870s house. And you see some of those boards are 1.5 inches thick on the edge. Look at that. That's like a 3-inch thick board right there, which means every one of the studs that it's nailed to has to be notched so that the surface, so it ended up making a surface at the edge. All different dimensions. You see the gaps between them. That's the shrinkage over time. When they built it, most of these were tight. That's the side view of this thing. This was a miner's cabin, basically. So they weren't too fussy about quality, but you see they're using big boards and little boards and pretty much anything. They want to make sure that every board that came out of the tree they could use. So they weren't going to say, well, they all have to be the same size. This is just a pine up here. This is I don't know which species of pine it would be in central Colorado. I think it's just pine. So before building codes and anything, so no stamps on all of it. And they're trying to preserve all this now. You can't build a new building. They actually picked this building up, built a foundation underneath it, and now they're adding on to it. I think it's on the market now for like $3.5 million for this 1,000-square-foot thing. But, you know, if you sit on your front porch, you can watch Bill Clinton bicycle by. Who else lives out there? Gosh. Ringo Starr, you can see walking around on the streets there. He's polite. So all the floor joists are going to be carried by this board that's notched in to the studs. So the vertical element is the balloon stud. There's our board that's notched in, and our floor joist is going to sit on top of that. So for that connection to fail, it would have to tear out all the wood fiber here. Today, we have to interrupt that stud space. Because it turned out one of the problems of this way of building was if you didn't interrupt it with what they're just calling blocking, if you had a fire in the basement, it would have a chimney, a clear chase to get up to the roof. Turned out that rodents really like that as well. They could move up and down real easily from the basement up to the upper floor. So the balloon frame had its own problems. They burned kind of quickly. They required big, beautiful pieces of wood. This is one of those notched-in ledgers that carry the floor joist. So this is a stair opening in an old house. This is another house they just picked up and moved 8 feet so they could build a multi-million dollar house, and then they'll put this back as the parlor. That's the notching. So kind of labor-intensive. And you see these studs have square corners, and they're not surfaced, and they look kind of chunky because these are actually two and a quarter maybe. The local sawmill was kind of generous. But it had its problems with fire moving from one place right through the other because there was no fire blocking and rodents. And so today we can still do balloon framing. We just have to provide at least 3 2-bys horizontally, so we get like 4.5 inches of solid wood to interrupt the chase space at least every 10 feet. And that's just to stop the movement of smoke and fire. Now, sometimes architecturally, it's necessary to have that two-story space, that great tall living room or that great tall entry. And today, if we tried to buy a 19-foot-long 2x4, what are the chances that it would be straight? Not very good, right? We just don't have those kind of trees anymore. We don't have that kind of forest anymore. So this is a 2.5-story tall stud, and this is the same material. I think you used this on the last solar house. We had a bunch of this donated. This is an engineered wood product, so it's like a oriented strand board, basically. This is the stamp that's on the side of it, LSL, Laminated Strand Lumber by Timber Strand. They're the manufacturer. But because they pretty much extrude this stuff, you can buy 25-footers, 30-footers, and it's always straight. It's expensive, it's hard on your saw blades a little bit, it's a little harder to nail into unless you've got a nail gun, but it's still possible to make those balloon frames, and you'll see it when people really need to have that two-story space, the balloon frame is the answer. Now, this is pretty much how we're building today. We're not building one wall that goes from the foundation of the roof anymore. We're building two little walls and balancing kind of one on top of the other. And, of course, if we try to stand a 2x4 wall on top of a 2x4 wall, it'd be almost impossible, right? So we put the floor in between it, and that's what makes it we call it the platform frame, because we're building a work platform, and we're building the wall. We're going to build the wall laying on the floor and then tip the wall up. Then we'll put on the second floor joists, put the plywood down, build the wall laying on the floor, tip the wall up. So what this had going for it kind of quickly was it had these horizontal plates. So when we build this wall on the floor, this horizontal piece of wood is nailed to the studs, and that horizontal piece of wood is nailed to the studs, and that keeps all the studs together, tip them up. This second one up here is just there to splice that wall to that wall. So it's literally just an overlapping splice at the corner. That's what that one's there for. And then we get the second floor joist, subfloor, and we start all over again. So we've got built-in fire blocks. It's really hard for mice and rats to move up and down through this. And you only need little pieces of wood. So almost any of us could tip one of these things up. The chances of me tipping up a 18-foot length of 18-foot high stud wall, no way. You know, I'm going to push it off the end of the platform. I'm never going to get it there. But this, I can tip one of these up myself, not 18 feet long. And this came out of the gold rush, basically. You see this emerge first in San Francisco, where they're, 1849, they discover gold. And San Francisco, It like triples in population in a year and a half or something. And houses are going for so much that people are prefabbing houses in Boston, putting them on sailboats, sailing them around the tip of South America up to San Francisco and selling them at, and still making 8 or 10 times what they invested. That's when the railroads start getting built across the Isthmus of Panama, because somebody figured out that if you sailed the boat into one side of Panama, drug the thing through the forest to the other side of Panama, put it on a boat, you could save 2 weeks and get it to San Francisco. But the first prefabs were that way, both timber frames and stud frames. But out in California itself, they were doing this just because a couple of people could build a house really quickly. You didn't need big lumber. So the first thing we do is we have the foundation walls here, and we put a floor down on a sill plate. The walls we're going to build laying flat on that floor plate, we'll tip those up, put the second floor on top of those, and start to build the next floor walls flat there. So we've always got a platform to work on. That's where the name platform framing comes from. So we tilt those up, and then we can build the roof. And in this case, the roof is just a roof joist and a collar tie to keep the roof from spreading, from pushing those walls out. So that was the whole sequence there in the notes. So pretty simple method, and we're still using it today. It gives us a lot of that lumber. Now, the only problem when we have lumber I guess it's not so much a problem. Are we going to get a lot of shrinkage this way in this plate? We know we won't get much shrinkage in the stud this way, because that's the way the tree grew, and the cells don't get shorter. They don't shrink up that way. How about in this thickness direction? We get a lot of shrinkage that way. So we get a little bit of shrinkage that way. But this is, now the tree grew this way. We've got a lot of lumber. We've got a lot of cells oriented 90 degrees to how it grew. We're going to see a lot of shrinkage here. In houses where they used the wood joists and they built brick walls around the outside, it's pretty common that if you dropped a ping pong ball or a marble in that house today, you drop it near the outside wall, it would just run like crazy to the middle of the house. Because those joists in the middle that are sitting on a wood bearing wall have shrunk, and the joists that are sitting out on the masonry wall haven't shrunk, haven't gone down. So you find those houses have doors that are cut at funny, wonky angles and things. They sell it as character. So let's see. So we stop the fire. We stop the rodents. And this is almost like what we were building maybe in late 1960. So we're starting to use plywood sheathing for it. That's how we make a stair. We basically take a 2x10 or 2x12 and we notch it out for the rise and run of the stair. So they'll talk about these things as a carriage or a stringer for the stair. And the rule is basically anytime you have to poke a hole in the floor or poke a hole in the roof or poke a hole in the wall, you double up the framing members all the way around the hole. That's the general rule. Poke a hole, double up everything. So we see doubled up joist here, doubled up ceiling rafters or roof rafters there. Doubled up studs here. We start out around this part of the country thinking about termites. Not as many people put in metal termite shields now because the chemical industry has gotten pretty good at making poison that they can inject into the soil. And a lot of the banks, to give you your loan on the house, will ask you for a certificate that the soil has been poisoned so termites can't live there. The only problem with that is that chemistry doesn't last forever, and it's chemicals you're putting in the ground. So the alternative to it is a mechanical, just a sheet metal, basically piece of flashing that we turn down the edges so when the little termites come out of the ground, they're making their spit tube, and they go up, and they go up, and then they bonk their little heads right there, and they can't get around that termite shield. That's the idea. And, of course, we put treated wood on top of that. So if this is ACQ, what does that have to be? What does that shield have to be? Galvanized or stainless, right? And usually the top of that wall isn't perfect. If it's concrete, it's hard to get that troweled exactly level when you're working inside of a form. Concrete block, they can actually get closer to being really level with the top of the wall. So between the bottom of this treated plate and the top of that wall, we'll put a gasket now, closed cell foam, and they'll just talk about it as a sill seal. Yeah, there's the sill seal. And the building code wants us to separate dirt from wood by at least 8 inches, mostly so that you can see as a homeowner you've got mud tubes, which means termites are active, and either call the Orkin guy or do something else to chase them away. We already talked about the wood. So on top of that then goes this piece of wood. It's a 2x10 or a 2x12. It's usually matching the depth of the floor joist. And it's first put up around the edges of it so that you can square up the framing and so you can have something to nail the joists into so the joists don't fall over. Because until that subfloor is on top of those joists, it's really not stable. Those things can move pretty easily. So this, we'll talk about that as a ribbon or a rib band or rim joist, and then our floor joist. We'd like to have at least 1.5 inches overlap onto that plate. The subfloor today, the plywood guys are still doing pretty good. They're selling 3/4 inch thick plywood with tongue and groove edges and sometimes a little bit thicker, and saying if you use this adhesive and this kind of fastener, we'll guarantee the floor won't squeak in so much time. So that goes down next. And the principle of, and this is almost true in every kind of structural system, if you've got structure going in one direction, that's your primary, your secondary structure is going to go at 90 degrees to that, and the decking will go 90 degrees to that. It's like a basket weave. Every layer of structure is 90 degrees to the layer beneath it. So in this case, the long axis of the plywood is spanning across the 16 inches instead of being parallel to it. Now, the other thing that we'll make sure we'd like to do is not have the plywood joints kind of line up all the way through. They have a tendency to sort of show up through a lot of different flooring materials, some carpets like this thin carpet, it would show through. One of the backup systems for hiding that and maybe even making a stronger floor is to add one more layer on top of the plywood called underlayment. Sometimes this would be just a 1/4 inch sheet of plywood. They'll just call it Luon, and it's really just there to hide the joints in the subfloor. They'll put down cement board when you're going to put tile in the bathroom, so it makes a better substrate for the grout. And I think when we do acoustics, we'll be able to talk about some pourable gypsum fillers that will be used as underlayment in order to increase the acoustical performance, like in apartments or professional buildings, and increase the fire resistance of that floor system. The cheapest way to make a foundation is to put in a crawl space, not a full basement. We don't have to go down 5 feet to hit frost depth, so why would we put in a basement unless someone's willing to kind of pay for that value or we need that space for utilities or something? So the crawl space is the common approach. And it has a couple of challenges for us around here because of our humidity. We can actually have the lumber start to disappear in relatively short order, because if we do the crawl space, and it's kind of strange, if you do the crawl space according to code, you can actually end up with more moisture in the crawl space than if you did it another way. So we'll look at both ways here. And the biggest problem with a crawl space, of course, is all of that earth right there, that is a moisture source to the house forever. So if someone calls you up and says, I've got this musty smell, or I have a mold problem, or the house is always damp, look down there first, because one of the cheapest things that can be done to fix it is put a vapor barrier over that so that all of that water in the ground can't work its way up into the house. The code will ask for this to be 18 inches at least above the dirt. If you're building for someone you care about or designing for someone you care about, think about a little bit more, because that 18 inches is barely enough space to crawl in there on your back and try to find that plumbing leak. Crawling in there on your back trying to get to that plumbing leak, and just when you get there, the big spider falls in your face. Ah! A little more space, you know, you can dodge the spider a little bit. And, of course, the worst part is running into, like, a porcupine in one of those things, or a skunk. The code says you can cut that 18 inches down by 3 to 6 inches if you'll put a vapor barrier down there to minimize moisture migration. The old strategy used to be To get rid of that moisture, you put holes in the foundation wall and vented that space, like we do for roofs. We'll talk about that. And the code says that ratio of vent square footage to the floor space is take the floor area, divide it by 150. That's how much vent space you had to have. And you could knock that down. If you get the vents near the corner, you could knock it down to 1 to 500. So take the floor area, divide it by 500. That's how much vents you got to have. The problem is in hot, humid climates, and I guess this only started when we started air conditioning houses, so this is sort of a new problem. When we put that air conditioning duct down in the crawl space, it's pumping, I don't know what, 70-degree air, 68-degree air into the house, and cooling down the house, which cools down the framing, and it's pretty easy to get the framing actually below the dew point, which makes it a condensing surface. And then you start to get this. If you crawl down in the basement, it looks like it's been on fire and there's a bunch of white fuzzy stuff, go get your Tyvek hazmat suit before you go back there. That stuff, so this is basically eating the framing at this point, all that slime mold and the white decay fungi. This is especially a problem down on the Piedmont. Up here in Blacksburg, where it's a little bit drier, it's not so much. Get down around Charlotte, head towards Raleigh, Tallahassee, it becomes a real problem. And one of the, so basically the thing that's causing it is, almost every failure is caused by two or three factors. Here we've got the code saying you've got to have vents, which means you've got this supply of humid air coming into the crawl space all the time, and you're running the air conditioning, which just keeps cooling the space and making more and more condensing surfaces. That hot, humid air hits that cold surface of the framing, and you get liquid water, basically. You get the water saturating the lumber over time, and you get mold, because mold is pretty much everywhere. So this is our problem. 90 degrees, 80% humidity, got a duct that's working 68-degree air in their code-complying ventilation space. So we get 72 degrees up there. And if we look at one of those charts, we have 80% humidity, 90 degrees. Our dew point's actually 82 degrees. And if that duct is working 68-degree air, it's way cooler than the condensing point. But the building code says we got to have it, except they always write in sort of an except because they want to let themselves off the hook, except when warranted by the climate conditions. So you don't have to do it otherwise, which means if you cover the ground with an approved vapor retarder and you treat the crawl space like it was a room, insulate the walls, and condition the space, you're not going to have a moisture problem in there. Basically, you're treating it just like it was an inhabited basement. You have to supply air to it. You have to supply dehumidification to it, just like you do the rest of the house. So on the one hand, operating-wise, from an energy perspective, it's more expensive because you've just added a bunch of square footage you really can't use for anything, right? And now you're heating and cooling that space. So you could say that's bad. From a long-term cost perspective, the cost of replacing the framing is much less or much more than conditioning that space during those cooling seasons. There's an alternative, though. It's a little more high-tech, and basically you do the same thing. You put a vapor barrier on the floor, insulate the walls, and then you put an exhaust fan in the wall. And it's got to be a smart fan. You got to have dampers on both sides of it, and the fan has to sense that the relative humidity outside is lower than the relative humidity in the crawl space. And if that's satisfied, then it says, okay, open the louvers and bring in that air and ventilate the crawl space. But it has to have enough smart to know that if the humidity in the crawl space is less than the humidity outside, don't open the vents, because otherwise you're going to be bringing in more humidity. So it's a little trickier from a control perspective. But in terms of operating cost, it's a little bit less because you're not having to condition the space, and you're pretty sure you're not going to have to replace the framing. All right, so once our crawl space is up and we've got our floor down, we're going to build the wall on top of it. And the terminology for the walls, they talk about the vertical sticks as studs, common studs. Next to an opening, the stud that goes all the way up to the plate is the king. The one inside that's the trimmer. And what spans across an opening is a header. So a door and a window have a lot of the same terminology to it. I have no idea where these come from. And I know when you go to different parts of the country, actually carpenters call them different things. So it's kind of a vernacular language. The studs that we buy, if we're trying to make an 8-foot space, generally we're not buying an 8-foot stud anymore because sawing off that last couple inches to compensate for the thickness of that bottom plate, the thickness of the first top plate and the second top plate just didn't make any sense. So now you can buy a pre-cut stud that's actually 92 5/8 inches, and that subtracts out the thickness of this, the thickness of that, and the thickness of this, and gives you the perfect length stud so you don't have to do any sawing on the job site. There'll be a little gap at the bottom, but basically that's how the sheetrockers get the sheetrock up against the ceiling, is they'll use that little gap, that little 5/8 inch at the bottom, to lever the sheetrock up against the wall. So that really speeds up construction if we don't have to saw all those things. And if we make a mistake and we buy 8-foot studs, then our sheetrock is going to end up being a couple inches short, which is embarrassing. So that's for our 8-foot ceiling. We can have a standard, we can get a pre-cut stud. When we put the two walls together, tip two of them up, there's that second plate, which just overlaps onto this wall so that it splices those things together. A bunch of nails go right through that connection, and that holds those two pieces together for the most part. We're going to have to add lateral bracing to that. And the corner itself, we've gotten a little smarter about it. It used to be you would just stack up a bunch of lumber to make a corner, but we realized that from an energy perspective, this just made a solid mass of material, and we would pump heat through that. Even though it's wood, we pump a lot of heat through that. This came to us probably in the middle 70s. Again, it came from California. You'll hear some people talk about it as a California corner. And it's basically just a way of, here's this stud wall, and there's that stud wall. And the only purpose of this stud right here is to make an inside nailing surface for sheetrock going that direction and sheetrock going this direction. That one too. One of the, I guess, the first dumb mistakes I made on a set of drawings in the office was I made this face of the stud line up with that face of the stud. And the carpenters were, you know, they were sort of anxious to tease me, so they built three walls that way. And they brought me out there and said, what do you think? And I said, well, you did great. You lined those things up perfectly. And they said, well, what do you think the sheetrocker is going to think? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, how's the sheetrocker, what are you going to nail to in the corner right there? I said, oh, hadn't thought about that. I had to buy fried chicken for the crew, and then the crew fixed it. They were nice guys. When we make these nailed connections down here, they are not rigid connections. If you've taken structures, you know that a rigid connection in steel is called a moment connection, one that maintains a 90-degree relationship throughout loading. These aren't that. These, you got to think of, are as a pin connection, basically. And the nails are flexible. If we put nails in from the bottom like this, any one of us by hand can pull that out, right? So usually you're going to get some nails that go in at an angle. They'll call it a toenail. And that'll help give you vertical resistance, but not resistance to racking from the wind. So we looked at that old balloon frame house that had a diagonal wood board. Basically, they would lay the board over the wall studs. They'd mark with a pencil where the board was going to cross every stud. And then they'd take and saw little slots, 3/4 inch thick, the thickness of this board, and take a chisel and carve out those little pockets, and then put the board in and it wasn't quite right, and then cut a little more and put it in, and cut a little more and put it in. Incredibly labor intensive. So we don't do that anymore. We do something like that. There it is, notched into the face of the stud. But anytime you make a triangle, basically, you've got a stable structural condition. So this is what we're using now, a piece of metal that basically all we got to do is once we've got that wall squared up, laying flat, we can take a chalk line and snap a chalk line across the face of the studs, come back and follow that with a saw and cut a slot, a kerf, lay a T-shaped piece of steel in there, and put a nail through it into each stud. And there's one that's not T-shaped, it's an angle, but there's the kerf. That's what it looks like. So really simple. And if you need to not have a chunk of plywood in the corner for some reason, this is a good alternative for wind bracing. There it is in my backyard. So I'm just using siding. I don't have plywood over the outside of the shed. I just wanted to be able to paint the inside all white and the outside so I could see the siding back there. But that works. It's really fast and works very well. Now the other one that's really common is you just nail up a sheet of oriented strand board or a sheet of plywood, and as long as you get at least a 4-foot sheet on the corner, on both sides of the corner, the building code will most of the time accept it without having a fully engineered solution. If you've got to have a window in the corner for some reason, you've just got to have an engineer design the wind bracing for the building. When you see houses that are completely covered with oriented strand board, usually it's to provide a nail base for vinyl siding. It's not there for all structural reasons. The pieces in the corners are doing most of the work. So all we're trying to do is to make basically a structural diaphragm 90 degrees to each other on two sides of the wall. And we can do that out of oriented strand board or plywood. And usually the structural panel you put on the walls is the half-inch material. So we're using 3/4 inch for the floors, 1/2 inch on the walls, 1/2 inch on the roof. Now the plywood industry figured out that if they could make their structural diaphragm actually work as finished material, they'd really have an advantage in the market. And someone asked the other day about what T111 plywood was. T111 was basically a sheet of plywood that would have either a cedar veneer or a medium density fiberboard finish, a paintable weather resistant finish. And just by nailing up the siding, we would get all the structural resistance out of the system. So we could eliminate one component from the process. I think if you look at a lot of the apartment buildings around town, that's how they work. They're just plywood siding, which means the siding is becoming the structural brace against the wind. So really fast. The biggest problem with this system is it's a whole bunch of parts. I think we did a count and came up with over 50,000 parts going into a little wood house. Because we have a bunch of parts, we've got a bunch of places where water can come in. The traditional method for dealing with this, and I'll say traditional, this is 1960 to present, was to try to seal up that face of the building. To use, and I've heard people talk about it as a chemically dependent strategy. So they use caulking and sealant at every gap to try to stop the water from getting behind that exterior siding and into the structure, into the inside. And it turns out that when you put this chemistry together, it's just really hard to get it all perfect. If there's a little bit of fried chicken residue on the edge of that board there, a little bit of mud on that one there, you won't get a good seal. And then you've got an opening for water. And if the real problem comes when you get water in here and the sealant joint down here doesn't fail, now you've trapped the water in the wall. So this is a face sealed system, and the idea is we keep all the water out, and it turns out it's really almost impossible to do. This is what's emerging. This is what people are starting to do now. They're saying, you know what? Take and separate the siding from the sheathing so you get an airspace behind the siding. They call it a rain screen. Masons have known this for a long time. This is the way you make a brick veneer wall, is you have a little bit of airspace, because if water goes through, it can't jump across the airspace. It's got no way to get across there. So it falls down, and we drain it out on pieces of flashing. So this uses basically a combination of, I guess you'd call it inertia removal. So the rain, the drive of the rain is hitting the siding and not being able to drive through and jump that little gap. Partly because the air pressure back here is going to be almost the same as the air pressure out there. In cladding, we'll talk about this again. Whenever we can have the air pressure as same on both sides of the siding, there's no push of the wind, basically, to drive moisture in. I bet of all of you that are building or have built, has anyone done this? No. So when I did my house, I wanted to know, so I did two sides of the house, the traditional way of putting the siding right on the felt paper, right on the paper over the plywood, and I did two parts of the house where it was on an inch and a half airspace, and I thought there'd be some big dramatic difference in the way the paint lived. Turned out there wasn't. But I haven't had as much trouble with water in the part that has this as I have with the other parts. I've had more siding splits and things. Well, typically what you do is once you get the house wrap or the building paper on the outside of sheathing, you go back and you strip over the top of it with a 1x2, and then the siding goes over the top of that. The fiber cement guys are kind of happy with that because it keeps the moisture level about the same on both sides of fiber cement. Most of the wood siding people are pretty happy with that for the same reason. But it's an extra component now. But what it means is you don't have to worry about the sealant being perfect, because the best sealant we can sell now is 25 years. And that's commercial. When a residential painter puts the sealant on, odds are it isn't going to go 25 years. We can go around most houses and find it cracked and missing, probably in 5. So this uses the laws of physics to keep the house dry for a long, long time. And this is what the building science guys are saying. They're saying, assume water is going to go in the wall. First, make the wall so you can drain it. And second, if you separate the kind of source of the water, the siding, from the structure, then you have less of a chance of getting water back into the insulation and making mold in the house. So this is the ChemBio building under construction. So it's a concrete block wall, insulation. This is a drain board, just like a foundation drain board. That's the air cavity, because between those little dimples, there's a free airspace. Fiber on the outside to keep the mortar from getting packed in and plugging the airspace, and then hokey stone. That means that this will be a continuous draining airspace forever. Won't be plugged up by anything. So that's how we're keeping masonry walls dry today. This is looking behind a cavity wall up at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, seeing that big airspace. And even the stucco guys are saying, you know, when we put stucco on, it'd be better if you take, and before you put the lath on, you put these little strips on, and all they're doing is they're trying to get just an eighth of an inch of separation, just a little bit, because for them, they're using that as a drainage channel. They know they're going to get water through the cracks in the stucco, and they want that to run all the way down and drain the water out, not trap the water in that wall somewhere. The building science guys are also saying, you know, this is sort of old school, take and put tar paper on the outside of the building. But they're saying the really good thing about it is, because it's paper, if there's some water that gets in there, it'll absorb that water, and when the sun comes around after the rain and hits it, it'll dry it back out. And the problem with the house wraps, because they're plastic, you can't absorb any water in them. So any water that hits them in the face is going to run down, and if you haven't designed the wall to drain, it's going to puddle up down there near the bottom somewhere. So that's what they're saying, is that's a little better. One of the traditional places where you find the houses rotting away first is where a roof hits a sidewall. So we're looking at, this is the remnants of a roof that used to project out at us coming into a sidewall, and it had good flashing next to it, but because of that water picks up a lot of speed running down there, it kind of runs down the siding, and you see all the siding is rotted. What they're saying now is wherever you do that, you should have one more piece of flashing that's bent out a little bit, and they call it a kick out. And the idea is the water runs down between the wall and the roof and then zooms out and gets into the gutter. So it doesn't run off and eat up the siding. Kick out. Every once in a while, we innovate. We bring new products to housing because we're trying to either achieve something, get higher performance or lower cost or a different look or something. One of the last ones that happened was bringing this artificial stucco to wood construction. So what's on PKs, what's on the outside of PKs, what's actually the infill panels up above here in Whittemore is a sheet of foam plastic insulation, beadboard, the white stuff, covered by a fiberglass mesh, troweled on with an acrylic modified, kind of a plasticized stucco layer that's really, really thin, maybe an eighth inch. Worked well on masonry construction for, it had about a 50-year track record in Europe, did pretty well. When we started putting it on wood construction, and this was in one of the Piedmont counties of North Carolina, they were sort of shocked to find out that because this acrylic modified stucco is moisture impermeable, and we would typically, before we put the sheetrock on, we'd put some kind of vapor barrier there. We actually had a situation where we stopped vapor from the outside and stopped it from the inside. And in theory, that's really good. You'd say, well, two ways of stopping water vapor is better than one, isn't it? The problem was that bulk water, water in liquid form, would get in there, and now you had a terrarium. No way to get the water out. And all over North Carolina, they had to go in and tear this stuff off. There, because the wood just started going away. They'd tear some of these apart 5 years old, and there literally would be, the bottom of the studs would be gone, because the decay organisms had this perfect, perfect growing environment between those two surfaces. Go back there and look. So what the building science guys are saying, if you're going to use that artificial stucco, make sure you've got some kind of a drainable surface behind it. And in fact, the industry, after a bunch of lawsuits, class action lawsuits, most of them have a styrofoam sheet that's got little cuts in the back of it so that it drains out. So it's a free draining board. Sorry. Got a little off there. All their failures were happening where you poked a hole in that acrylic modified stucco, doors and windows. Because the typical strategy was you had a little pre-made window that had a little flange, a plastic flange, a nailing flange that you'd nail over the house wrap, and you'd put tape on it, and you'd call it good. You'd say that was it. And it turned out you actually need, there's one of those drainage strips. This is the rain screen wall. So we have this space where water can run behind the siding and drain out. I'm going to stop there today, and I'll pick this back up on Tuesday for you. Thanks. See you all then.